Welcome to a Men of His Word audio recording. Men of His Word is a conference that equips Christian men to take a leadership role within their family, congregation, and community. Go to menofhisword.org to find information on upcoming conferences and resources. This is the keynote given in Oshkosh on February 17, 2024. Dr. Michael Berg is an associate professor of theology at Wisconsin Lutheran College. He is the author of several books, including Vocation, The Setting for the Human Flourishing. He is also the host of the podcast, Let the Bird Fly.
Thanks for having me. Let's start with the Tower of Babel. This is a fascinating story to me for a couple of reasons. One is that when God comes down to mess with us, he messes with our words, because our words are our most powerful thing. And then, of course, in Pentecost, we get the word of Christ through the Spirit that undoes Babel. That's kind of cool, too. But what really fascinates me about this story is that it's almost as if God is afraid of us, right? And so the people of the world have come together in cities, and they have built this great tower. They're going to reach up into the heavens. They're going to touch God. They're going to be like God, making the same mistake as Adam and Eve. And then we get a little insight into the Holy Trinity's inner conversation, and they say, we have to do something, because who knows what they can do? All things will be possible for them, so to speak. And that means that we have great potential. We have great potential for evil, but we also have great potential for good. And the reason for that is that we're created in the image of God. We're something special. We have great potential. And we know it. And that's why we're often discontent, because we know we were made for something better. We know that we were made for greatness. I'm the oldest of six kids, and not really great kids. I mean, we were okay, but, you know, my mom, that poor woman, right? She was pregnant for 9 years, and I think she sort of just kind of survived. I was the oldest of six kids, and so I kind of knew what was coming when it came time for me to be a father. In fact, there is not one thing that has surprised me in my 20 years of being a father, not one. But that didn't make me confident about being a father. It actually made me petrified, because I knew what was coming. I had seen it, and I knew what kind of patience and love it would take. And I didn't think I had it in me. So I was a little worried. And then I held that baby girl in my arms for the first time, and I knew I had it in me. I could do this. But then I put myself into this position where I had another ceiling, like I'm tapped out. So when my wife was pregnant with our second daughter, and I'm not proud of this, but I remember distinctly thinking, I'm not going to like the second kid. And the reason for that is because I couldn't take any love from that two-year-old girl who was jibber-jabbering all the time with little pigs. And I couldn't do that. That's not how love works, right? I couldn't divide it in half. There was no way that I could do that. And I remember thinking to myself, in all seriousness, I'm going to have to fake it. Otherwise, this kid's going to be ruined. And then I held that second baby girl in my arms, and the ceiling that I had, the potential that I thought I had for love, was shattered. And when my wife was pregnant with our third child, now I knew, I would have enough love. I wouldn't have enough patience or money or time, but I would have love. And I started to think that maybe my love was infinite. I'm finite, and so I suppose my love is finite, but I can't see the ceiling. But then I realized it was God's love through me to them, and so it really was infinite. I'll mess it up. It'll come out diluted and stained, but it'll never run out. because it didn't originate with me. I have this potential, and so do you. But I also have great potential for evil. It was not the great tyrants in the history of this world that carried out the great genocides. It was regular guys like you and me. Great potential for evil. But I also have great potential for love. And so when I held that third baby girl in my arms, I knew. I knew I would have enough love. Now I just want them to stop hitting things with my cars, you know? Leave me alone for a little bit, but that's a different story. Yeah, all right. So we have great human potential, and we know it. And so if we go back to that passage that we heard about in Ephesians chapter 2, 8, 9, and 10, you know it, right? We're saved by grace alone. And that we are God's handiwork, his workmanship, his craftsmanship. That idea there, I think, shows the amount of respect God has for you and for me. That he wouldn't just save us, but that he would also use us. It's a very honorable thing. And a thing you and I don't deserve. We know that we don't deserve grace, but I would also suggest that you don't deserve to be the bus driver or the carpenter or the father either. But rather that God elevates you higher than you ever thought possible with his infinite love through you. So think about that for a second, how God respects you. Now, I like doing this in front of groups where if I say agree or disagree, respect is earned. And everybody says, oh, yeah, of course. But this is a terrible way to go through life. That means I don't respect any of you. You got to earn it, right? And I don't think I have the right to say whether you should be respected or not because you're created in the image of God. You can lose respect, but you should never have to earn it. Yeah. Now think about what the Father did for Adam in particular. He said, I'm going to create you, this is going to be great, or whatever, and then he gave him a job. He called him to do something, which is really profound. We don't think about this enough. He gave them the job to name the animals. To name something, that's pretty serious, right? God could have named the animals like he did Adam and Eve, but he gave that to Adam, and he said to him, I need you to do this. And Adam was lifted higher than any other man, perhaps, besides Christ, right? To name things, right? When I got married, God didn't say this in my ear. He said it through pastors and teachers. But he said to me, he said, Michael, I got this lady, and I want this lady to be adored. And to be respected and to be encouraged and to be put on a pedestal as Christ does the church. And Michael, you idiot, I choose you. I need you to do it. One of my favorite professors would say to us, God chooses to need you. Well, it's an oxymoron. You don't choose to need anything. None of you woke up today and said, I choose to need air today. You don't choose to need things. And let alone God choose to need something that is finite seems bonkers crazy. But what is he doing there? He's honoring you. He's lifting you up to the potential that he created you in the image of God. The bus driver doesn't deserve to be the bus driver. And the accountant doesn't deserve to be the accountant. But here is God calling you for these things. That professor would say something like this. He would say, God chooses to need you so you're not a waste of space. You need a reason to get out of bed in the morning. So I teach at college, and these kids, they will, at the end of the semester, they're just like, we're just so busy. We can't get this stuff in, you know? And I go, I apologize. We should have told you about the assignments at the beginning of the semester. Yeah, I apologize for that. We'll even put it like in a document and give it a fancy Latin name, you know, like syllabus or something like that. Yeah. And then I say, I think it's adorable you think you're busy. You have no idea. You have no idea how busy you're going to be in a few short years. But you rise to the occasion, right? God will get you there, right? He'll set the bar a little bit higher each time. And then I say, there's one thing worse than being too busy, and that's not having a reason to get out of bed in the morning. You need a calling from God. You need purpose, otherwise you'll fall apart, right? So remember that when you're too busy. Yeah. Okay, vocation. Let's talk vocation for a second. Let's just do some nuts and bolts things here just for a little bit. Vocation means calling. You see the word voice there. And there are three components to a calling or a vocation. You have a caller, you have the called, and you have the neighbor. We like the first two, right? Well, I feel like I'm called by God, right? And then it ends there. But the vocation's not about you. It's decidedly about the neighbor. And so a true vocation always has those three components. It has the caller, that's God, the called, the Christian, and the neighbor, whoever that may be. I like to think of four categories of vocation where God says, I need you. Your first one is your family vocation. There are many vocations in this category. Father, son, brother, keep going. Your second one is maybe we'll loosely call your career vocation. You don't have to get a paycheck to be in this category. A student, retired person, a volunteer, whatever occupation you have right now, God says, I need you for that. Then you have your civic vocation. For most of you, it's just to be a voter. Maybe some of you are on the town council. And then you have your ecclesiastic or your church vocation. For most of you, it's to be a member of a church. But you could be pastor, you could be church council member, and all the rest. This is also the place, vocation, where you do spiritual warfare. So we have this thing called the sinner saint. You are 100% sinner and 100% saint all at the same time. And I know the math doesn't work out, but it sure explains your life, that one moment you can be a delight and the other moment a not. And I think this is really important to understand for a variety of reasons. One, maybe a little comfort here, like, you read St. Paul about being content in every situation, and you're like, crap, I'm not content, right? Or we say, don't worry, you know? And then you're like, well, now I'm worried about worrying. And you can never get out of there. What I think is helpful is to say, you're a sinner saint all at the same time. The sinner does things that are always sinful. The sinner always sins. By definition, the sinner always sins. The saint, on the other hand, always does righteous things. The saint always saints. The sinner always sins. The saint always saints. And so I think you should ask yourself not the question, am I content or discontent? Is this sinful or not? Ask yourself, who's doing it? The sinner's discontent for selfish reasons. But the saint is discontent in an imperfect world, longing for heaven. The sinner worries because he does not trust. The saint worries because he loves. Yeah? So vocation, which is your life, whether you know it or not, is where you have this spiritual battle between sinner and saint. The sinner looks at the neighbor as an annoyance, right? And you've done this, right? The coworker who just cannot get stuff done, right? This person's a burden to me, right? The sinner looks at the neighbor as an annoyance at best, or something that is to be used. Let's go down that path for a little bit. So I'm a professor, and so I look over freshmen a lot all day, and bless their hearts, right? Anybody from Texas? And once you say bless your heart, that gives yourself permission to say something bad about them. Yeah. bless their hearts. But my goodness, some days, you know. And I have a choice to look at them as somebody that I would use or somebody that I would love. So maybe I think, and I don't think this way, but maybe I think of my calling here as a professor, I want to do academic work. I want to read and write and all that kind of stuff, but that didn't pay well. And so I got to teach freshmen in order to put food on the table. But I really want to do is something else. Those souls in front of me then become something I use for a different end than love. I have misused them. And if I misuse them, I have abused them. Yeah. And there are days. But I'm also a saint in the blood of Christ, and I love them. And I get up every morning loving them and thinking about what's best for them. And that's your life, isn't it? Right? That's your life. And so the battle between sinner and saint, the battleground is vocation. Your marriage and your family and your job and your church and your government. And it's rough out there sometimes. But ultimately, you are the saint. You are the saint. Okay. Let me talk about calling just for a little bit. We want to distinguish between the call to faith and then the call that God gives you in your vocations. Do not mix those. Right? You are called by faith no matter what your job is, no matter how well or poorly you do in your vocation. And so this is the realm of sanctification, not the realm of justification. Speaking of justification, yeah? Let's go back to a guy who really did a lot of work on vocation. His name was Martin Luther. And he finally understood that the desire for human beings to be right, to be righteous, to be just, this concept of justification, this desire cannot be fulfilled by a law, right? I cannot be righteous by law. I need to be righteous on account of what Christ does for me. Can never get there. And even if I could be righteous by law, by the way, that makes God not a loving father, but he makes him a tyrant of a boss. He says, you do this, then I love you. You do this, then I reward you. That ain't love. That's like bringing your baby home from the hospital after being born in the cute little car seat, and you put the car seat down on the front porch, and you're like, hey, when you're ready to participate in this family and choose to be a part of this family and do your chores, we will then provide and love you, pride for you and love you, and knock when you're ready. Why do we think God would be that way? And so Martin Luther understood that he was righteous by grace, and really by grace, not just a little bit, but by the whole deal. Well, the problem for Luther was he had spent his whole adult life working towards pleasing God by this righteousness by law as an Augustinian friar. And he did it, man. I mean, he did all the prayers and he did all the things. He never did anything halfway. And once he was freed from using all of his time and all of his energy in pleasing God, he's like, what's a monk to do? I mean, seriously, what's a monk to do with all of his time now and all of his energy and all of his work? And he finally figured it out. It was to love neighbor. And so you're never just free from, you are always free for, right? The American concept of freedom that we heard in the devotion is to do whatever I want, however I want, with whomever I want, as often as I want. That ain't freedom if you're just indulging the sinful appetite. In fact, that's the worst kind of prison. No, freedom, if freedom from sin is true freedom, and the opposite of sin is love, then freedom is love. Now think about that. Freedom is love. Seems to be a little bit of a problem there, because love doesn't seem to be about myself and whatever I want to do, but about others. But think about it. Think about your day. Think about those moments when you just do something in front of you because it needed to be done. And you didn't do it for the paycheck, and you didn't do it for, you didn't do it to get credit. You didn't do it for any other reason than that's just what needed to be done. And so you did it. Those are good moments. That's you, the saint. That's freedom from worry. That's freedom from sin. That's freedom from self-justification. And so freedom is actually love. And so what Luther talked about was an ethical reorientation. No longer is my ethical orientation a vertical one with God. but now it is a horizontal one with my neighbor. Luther's really good for this, and if you've ever read any bit of Martin Luther, he says something off the wall, bonkers crazy, and you're like, what? And then like 4 pages later, he explains it or rolls it back. When he was commenting on 1 Corinthians 7:20, he said this. He says, what does it matter if a man leaves his wife? That doesn't matter to God. What is it to God if a man is a good husband or not? That man, if he has faith, is righteous in Christ, there's nothing he has to do. It doesn't bother God. It means nothing to God if he leaves his wife. And you're like, what are you talking about? And then a few pages later, he says, that man owes nothing to God. He's not in an ethical orientation with God anymore, so stop it. But that man owes everything to his bride, his whole existence, his soul, and his entire body. Yeah. And Luther is channeling St. Paul there, where we are free. Don't let anybody tell you you're a slave. Don't let anybody tell you that you are a prisoner to the law. You are free, period. End. But you are also slave to love, to others, right? You are bounded to this. It's a completely different way of thinking about your ethics and your life, right? And we slip into thinking these things incorrectly. There's a lot of shorthand in the Bible. Let me go down this road for a little bit. There's a lot of shorthand in the Bible. And I don't know that we pastors are very good at stopping and explaining that shorthand. I don't know. We always talk about the glory of God. Glory of God this, glory of God that, glory of God this, all the time. And it's almost like God's like this narcissist that needs, he's like an egomaniac. He needs our praises, right? We better give glory to God. Otherwise, the big guy's going to be upset. Or it's like this fake humility. And we're like, I know I hit the home run, but just so you know, I did it to the glory of God. Probably not, but you did it to the glory. The glory of God is shorthand for this, that you're so secure in the love of Christ that you don't even think about pleasing him at all, and you just go live, and that is to his glory. And you fathers know exactly what I'm talking about. Because your glory of your children is not that when they were little kids, they would go out and play, and then they would stop, and they would turn around and be like, Dad, was that good enough? Did I live up to the family name? And after Little League, hit a home run, like, just so you know, I did this for the glory of Dad. If you were that dad, you were a bad dad. And if you had a dad like that, I apologize, right? So why do we think God is that way? No, the honor of the glory of the family is when you built your children to be who they were. And they went out into the world never questioning your love. Never questioning your love. But they just went, never looking over their shoulder to see if mom and dad were there with their approval, because they had it. And they went out and they just lived, and you sat back, and that's to my glory. And that is how it is with the Father. You're no longer in an ethical orientation with God because of Christ. Now you go and are in ethical orientation with your neighbor. Maybe one more thing on ethics while I'm thinking about it. This is a tough one for soldiers. Is my vocation, my calling, actually divine to kill? Luther addressed this. He even went so far as to say, he would go so far as to even talk about like the butcher being wrong because he killed. And he says that the commandment's not really do not murder, but do not kill. This is going maybe a little bit too far, but you can trace his line of thought here. It said it's even wrong for a husband to lust after his wife. It's always wrong to do these things. It's always wrong to judge. It's always wrong to judge. It's always wrong to kill. It's always wrong to lust. Period. That's the way it is. But then he would say, but if you're called to judge, like a judge or a father, if you're called to kill, butcher, soldier, If you're called to lust, not only is it okay, but it's your duty to do so. And he said these beautiful words that I hope you take home and will be comfort to you in your remaining years on life. He said, and the ethical obligation is on God and not you. If he called you to do it, then do it. And the ethical obligation is on God and the vocation and not on you individually. That's something, isn't it? That's something, right? So there's some interesting things here with Luther and vocation and ethics. All right. Let's go down to sinning against vocation. This is terrifying to me and should be terrifying to you. That when you sin, people get hurt. People get hurt. Because it's not just you and God, right? That's how we think. We're so individualistic. It's you and God, and I got my sin, and I feel sorry about it, God, and God says, all right, it's okay, and we move on, right? The problem is that you have harmed people with your sin. I don't think that there is a victimless crime. I think that's a falsehood. Because when you sin inside of your own mind or inside your own house or your own bedroom, your own private moments, it makes you who you are. And who you are privately is who you are publicly, whether you know it or not, right? It changes you. And when you commit sins, people get hurt. And the people that you love the most are the people you have hurt the most. Nobody has hurt your wife like you have. And nobody has hurt you like your wife, I'm willing to bet. I did a chapel at the college once, and I said, here's the deal, kids. You need to go home, and you need to absolve your parents because they're carrying a lot of guilt because nobody messes up children like parents. And they're holding a lot of guilt right now, and they're trying to be strong for you so they won't admit it in front of you. And usually they end up doubling down on the parenting to make up for those mistakes. I mean, they ruined you. So I want you to go home and I want you to absolve them. And I said, don't go in there and say, Dad, I forgive you in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. That would be weird. But I want you to go, and I want you unprompted, just say, I love you. And I'll tell you right now, when they hear those words, it will be like a waterfall of absolution flowing over them. Right? So, in vocation, when we sin against vocation, people get hurt, and this is devastating to us. But God's got our back, and when we ruin our vocations, he has other people in their vocations that are going to pick up the slack. So, if you are a father, and you have a father-in-law maybe sitting next to you, sometimes there's maybe a little tension there. Because father-in-law wants to give you wisdom, even if you don't want it. And you both have a neighbor, let's say your daughter, his granddaughter. Yeah? You both buy Christmas presents. You both go to the flute recital. You both have an obligation, invocation to this neighbor. But they're different. And the father is to be father, and the grandfather is to be grandfather, and that may mean father-in-law needs to keep his mouth shut once in a while. And that means that he's got to trust. He's got to trust, I don't have a call to be father. God gave that call to another man, and I have to trust. Even though I want to jump in right now, I have to trust. But we also can envision a place where the father is absent, passes away, can't be there for a legitimate reason, whatever it is. And he's failed his children. He's failed his daughter. But God's got his back. And the sphere of the grandfather then expands to maybe even be the father figure at times to the child. Yeah. God's got your back. Now, this is not ideal because the child needs to have father and grandfather. And if the child loses father, let's say, grandfather steps in, it's beautiful, but either she has a non-disciplinarian father or she loses the doting grandfather. But God still gets his work done in the imperfect world. So this ain't about you and your flaws as much as it is about God getting stuff done with or without you. He just honors you in your vocation. I want you to stop and think. We're so curved inward and think about, oh, I got this vocation, I got this vocation. Will you stop and think about how many vocations God used so that you could be in this building right now? We could be here for the rest of the day. Think, there was a carpet guy, and there was a carpenter, and there were some electricians, and there were some people, the bank financed this, and there was donors, and there was people. I mean, it's endless. The Beatles were wrong that the love you give is not going to be equal to the love you get. The love you get will far outpace the love you give, and it's not even close. So many people were used in their vocations for you. And you ain't paying it back. You're only just paying it forward in your little way. All right. Let's think about now this concept of the masks of God. So I'm switching gears a little bit here, but I think this is kind of cool. So think a Halloween mask, right? A mask goes over a person, right? And God hides, by the way. Let's start with that. God hides. He's not a hidden God in the sense where we can't see him, so he's hidden. No, it's a verb. He hides. He hides. This is what Isaiah said when God told him that the Persian king Cyrus would free the people of Judah and he would be a messianic figure. And Isaiah's like, what? Cyrus, our enemy, Cyrus, one of the worst dudes that has lived right now, a tyrant of a man, you call him Messiah? Surely you are a God who hides, Isaiah said. Surely you are a God who hides. Here's how God hides. He hides in nature, right? This is the book of nature. We can find him here. We don't find him in grace, though. We don't find him in his truth. We only find a very diluted sort of kind of fuzzy little thing. And when we get the information from God hiding in nature, we almost always make the wrong conclusion. God hides on the pages of Scripture. You ever thought about that? It didn't have to be words. He could have just zapped you with knowledge. You could have climb a high mountain and find some enlightenment, but he actually hid in words. So you can like open up the book and you could hear it beat upon your eardrum. Hides in the water of baptism. He hides in the bread and wine of communion. He hides in the ministry of the church. That's why your pastor says, I forgive you, because he stands in the stead of Christ. He hides in suffering. He hides in suffering, and he hides in vocation. Now, why does he do that? Why does he hide? Well, for one, if the full glory of God would come your way, your face would melt off. Right? And so I got to put Moses in the cleft of the rock, and only the backside of God could pass by. And still, Moses was glowing so much that they had to put a veil over him. So one, I think, is our protection. But he also hides to be intimate with us. And so there's a paradox here. He hides to be revealed. It's a paradox. He hides to be revealed. I never watched this movie, but I know the plot, and so do you. Mrs. Doubtfire, yeah? Robin Williams' character dresses up like the maid so he can be intimately close with his children who are living with his ex-wife. When God hides and puts on these masks, then he is intimate with you. You want to know where God is in your world? You're like, where is God? Right behind the firefighter and the teacher and the carpenter and your wife lurking around every corner, right? This is how he works. Think about this. God, almost exclusively, not always, but God's standard modus operandi is to use ordinary means for extraordinary ends. And his modus operandi, a standard MO, is to use physical means for spiritual ends. So you can touch it and see it and hear it and smell it. Right? Let me back up. Okay. Remember when you were a kid and you came home and your mom or dad gave you a snack, peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And because you were a good little boy, you said, "Thank you, Mom or Dad." And because you're a good little Christian boy, you said a quick prayer to thank God for that PB&J. And it never dawned on you that you thanked two people for the same sandwich. So who was it? God or Mom or Dad that made you the sandwich? Well, it was both. And it was God through Mom and Dad wearing the mask of God to do that. And you didn't realize this too, but also the farmer and the truck driver and the FDA inspector and the grocer and the person who packaged it and on and on and on. Why? So that you wouldn't starve and die. Yeah? So you wouldn't starve and die. Now, could God just zap food down in your backyard every day? Sure, he did it for 40 years in the wilderness. But that ain't no fun, right? And it would mean that the truck driver and the FDA inspector and the mother, whatever, wouldn't have a divine purpose in their life. So God is going to use ordinary things for spiritual ends, like the word and water and bread and wine. And he's going to use ordinary things to do extraordinary things so it's accessible to you. So it's accessible to you. And he is close with you. So he hides behind the masks so that he can be close to you and revealed to you. And by the way, the place where he is the most hidden, the cross, is where he is the most revealed. There you see how serious he is about sin. There will be a death. There you see how serious he is about mercy. It won't be your death. Yeah. I would go so far as to say that vocation is a Christological endeavor. So let's go to the last day. Let's jump ahead. And Jesus tells us about the last day, and he says, "I'll gather everybody else, and I'm going to separate the sheep from the goats, and I'm going to say to the sheep, 'Well done, fantastic guys. When I was hungry, you fed me. When I was thirsty, you gave me something to drink. When I was naked, you clothed me. When I was in prison, you came to visit me.'" And the sheep are like, "When were you ever naked? We didn't feed you. We didn't do any of that." And what does he say? "Whatever you did for the least of these brothers of mine, you did for me." So when you serve your wife, when you serve your children, when you serve your clients, when you serve whatever, you are serving Jesus Christ. Yeah? And we've already established the fact that when you're fed, when the plumber comes and fixes your plumbing, that's actually Christ hiding behind the mask, whether that person knows it or not, serving you. Christ to you, Christ to me. In everyday work, Christ to you, Christ to me, vocation is a Christological endeavor. So when you get a cold cup of water, literally, from the waiter or waitress, they are Christ serving you. And you are Christ to them. It's fascinating. Just think about how that changes your day-to-day operations. I bet you tip better now. You know what I mean? Right? And what about when I go to that gas station and that clerk doesn't give a flying whatever about me, you know? God still gets his work done, even though that person is sinning against their vocation. So I see that person as honorable, even if they're having a bad day, because that was Christ serving me. Right? And I almost feel bad because if they only knew what divinity was happening in front of them, they would have a little bit more joy as they gave me change. Right? Just think about how that changes your world. I would suggest that it is the basis for human dignity. We got a problem in our world with value and identity and all that kind of stuff. And the reason for that is because we're curved inward. So I've curved inward to find my truth, to find my morality, to find my value, to find my identity. This is a dead end. We've told our teenagers, don't look into society for your value. It's a good lesson. But we forgot to tell them that also don't look inside yourself, because you'll have a dark night. We told them, don't let anybody tell you you're not valuable. They're wrong. That's not their job. But we forgot to tell them it wasn't their job either. You are valuable extra nos outside of yourself. Your truth, your morality, your identity, your value all comes outside of you. And if it can't be outside of you and it's inside of you or in your society, then it's relativistic. Then what if society says I'm not valuable? What if I say I'm not valuable? What if I disagree with you about that? Then it's just my opinion versus your opinion, right? And so a lot of our human dignity, our human rights, all of these kinds of things, must come from outside of us. We got the grace part down, but I wonder if we don't get the vocation thing down very well. Vocation is one of those great leveling things, right? Remember when Samuel went to Jesse in Bethlehem, and he was going to anoint the new king after Saul, after God had rejected Saul, and Jesse puts his seven boys out, the strapping young ones. They had the Kennedy look. They would have been quarterback of the football team, you know? And I love it. Jesse's like, no, no. Or Samuel's like, no, 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 no. Is there any other ones? And Jesse's like, well, there's the runt of the litter, David. Somebody had to watch the sheep while we were, picking a new king. And Samuel's like, go get him. And he anoints David. And Samuel says, God looks at not what man looks at. Right? So how do we look at value and dignity in our world? Well, there's the classic shallow things, money, looks, likes, all of those kind of sinful, those kind of shallow things. But we are always asking that question, am I valuable or not, whether we're asking that question or not. Because we're always trying to seek our justification by law. Right? So we make a law, and then we say, I follow that. Or, if we're honest, we look at any law, whether God or human, and we go, we haven't lived up. Both of them are looking inside of themselves for their value when you should be looking outside of yourselves. And my contention is that even if you could check all the boxes of our society and yourself, like you got to the mountain in your career, like you had the perfect family and the perfect body and all that kind of stuff, I guarantee you that when you get to the top of that mountain, you'll get there and you'll say, is that it? And the reason for that is you're created in the image of God and you'll never be satisfied with anything less than perfection. You'll never be satisfied with anything less from perfection. Because that's who you are. So I think this explains why the NFL quarterback making $30 million a year wants to make 31. You're like, who cares? Can't be satisfied. I think it's also the reason why Hollywood throws itself an award show, I think every other week, is it? Yeah? And then complains about the attention. And it's why you can never be satisfied. Right? And so we strive for money, and we strive for success for all of the wrong reasons, and even if we get there, we are disappointed. You'll always want to make more. Everybody in this room makes the same salary, and that salary is just a little bit less than what we want. Yeah? I can remember, being a poor student and having a family or whatever, and I go, if I had just $500 more a month, oh, I'd be satisfied. I say it every year. right? I say it every year. And that $500 just goes right now to car repairs. But just, you know. All right. There's a pole. Our driveway's skinny, and there's a pole right there. And it's close to the driveway, but the pole doesn't move. It doesn't jump out. It doesn't change places. The pole always stays in the same place. I don't understand why they keep hitting the pole. All right, anyway. So we look at it that the senator from the state of Wisconsin is somehow, you know, you've made it. But God looks at the janitor working in the Capitol building as just as important. Because they're both doing God's work. Luther had an awesome line when he said, when a father changes a dirty diaper, and he said, Father, when a father changes a dirty diaper, the angels sing in heaven. Not because it's so rare. It shouldn't be. But because God wants clean rear ends. Of course he does. Do you think there ever was a crooked table coming out of the carpenter shop in Nazareth? Of course there wasn't. Of course God wants that for us and for those around us. And so he understands that if nobody cleans the bathroom, diseases run rampant, and who cares who's the senator from Wisconsin? And the world doesn't see it, but he sees it. He sees it. He sees what important things you do, whether the world knows it or not. Now, think about how that changes the pride you take in your work, right? So I like to use the analogy of cleaning the bathroom. So maybe you have taken pride and craft in this work, and you got a system. You start with the mirror and you work your way down. You even take that little plastic cap that covers the bolts that hold the toilet down. You know what I'm talking about. When's the last time you cleaned that, right? And you have pride in this. There's a right way to do it and a wrong way to do it. And you did it the right way. And you found joy in it. Pick whatever it is. Even your hobbies like woodworking or the spreadsheet that looks perfect, right? Or if you're a mason, that finished job, whatever it is. There's a right way and there's a wrong way to do it. There's craft there. I'm willing to bet that at lunch, if you just ask somebody about their job, and if they find pride in their work, they'll tell you more than you ever wanted to know about that work. Right? That's a good thing to have, right? The right way to do it and the wrong way to do it. And so what if you don't get credit for it? And so what if the kids come in and destroy the place in 5 minutes? You know the proper pride in that, and God knew. And the angels sang in heaven for a clean bathroom. Because it was for the love of neighbor and not for you to get credit. And so at the same time he says, don't look for the world for that credit, he's actually honoring you, right? And saying, my goodness, I mean, the angels are like, yeah, yeah, right? And that's the proper amount of pride and craft in your job. Maybe kind of a side note, if you are a so-called blue-collar worker, you know what I'm talking about here. And you can finish a day knowing if you were successful or not, because either the car started or it didn't. either the plumbing works or it didn't. Either the thing got delivered or it didn't. And you have an advantage over all the white collar workers over here, because you can go home and you can go, ha. Right? And you actually can sort of relax. When I think that people who are working in middle management, it's much difficult to know if you were successful or not. Right? Because you're managing hearts. I suppose you could just look at the bottom line, but you know that's not the only reason you did that work or your business exists or shouldn't. Right? And yet I would say that you can still find the pride and the craft in your work. Right? It's easy if you're a carpenter to find the craft. The right way to do it, the wrong way to do it, right? It's a little bit difficult when you're putting together spreadsheets, but you know what I mean. That when the CEO needs everything on one page and you get into his mind and you think, okay, this is what he needs to know and this is what he doesn't want to know, and I know he's going to get distracted with this, so I'm going to leave that off. And I'm going to put it all right here, exactly what he needs to know. There was a craft. It was a work of art to you, that one-page spreadsheet that you gave to him for that board meeting. And he looked at it, and he crumpled it away and recycled it as if there was no love and craft with it. But so what? God knew. God knew. Right? He honors you. He respects you in a way that you do not deserve. Let's switch gears here a little bit and talk about a thing called neo-monasticism. So this is a made-up word. Monasticism, right, was that idea, you dedicate your life to the work of the Lord. And they did good things. Monks did good things, right? They brewed beer, some good beer, the crafts and stuff like that, and they taught. A lot of them did that. But the problem was is that they were binding themselves where God did not bind them. They would say, we have to follow the rules, for instance, of celibacy or poverty or whatever. And so they were binding them by a law that God had freed them from. But that's not what really ticked off Luther, even though that was bad enough because it was a work righteousness kind of thing, right? I'm doing something for God, then he pleases me. He said, it's not just that they bind themselves where they're not bound, it's they free themselves when they weren't supposed to be free. They freed themselves from the love of neighbor, right? They weren't doing things for their neighbor. They were doing things sort of on behalf of their neighbor for God in a twisted way of thinking about it. So what's neo-monasticism then? Well, neo-monasticism is when we pastors, shame on us, get up on Father's Day and tell you to be good fathers, and then the bulletin has 14 meetings in there, most of them nonsense. We got a problem with that. We have this tension between we want the church to be busy, we want it to be active, we want it to be alive, but that takes time and volunteer hours and money and all that kind of stuff. And I don't think we've always appreciated that the time at church means not time in your vocation. I'll speak to pastors for a second. I don't know your church calendar, but I'm willing to bet you could cut it in half. Be more efficient with your meetings. And I don't know you, but I'm willing to bet you feel guilty about not being at every stinking thing at church. Let me give you the freedom to say no to your church and your pastor. You want to know what you need to be doing? Going to flute recitals and soccer games. And volunteering out in the world. And so there's a delicate balance there, right? I think a good church says, when we need you, we'll call you, but I'm not just going to make up stuff. We want to create a culture. We want to create belonging. We want to do that. We get that. But you need to be out in the world. That's where it happens. That's where love happens. That's where evangelism happens, right? And so it's something to think about, right? And the theological problem is this. It's called neo-monasticism, where we say you're only doing God's work if it's in the church building. No. You're doing God's work when you are fulfilling your vocations, and they're just as equal, and we don't fight against those. And there's no reason to fight against those, right? It's the same problem, right? The monks are like, yes, I could have a family. Yes, I could participate in civilization, but really God wants me to go and just live with the boys and pray every 3 hours. Are we that close to this impression that you're not holy enough unless you're doing the church work? I think we need to be careful about that, right? But the work still needs to get done. It's a very delicate balance, and I know that your pastors think about that, and you as church council members should think about that. What's the answer? Well, be efficient, right? Be efficient. The greatest gift you can be to a pastor is to run an efficient meeting, right? Right? Be efficient. And then don't make up meetings or things for the sake of things. And when you do come, make it meaningful. Okay, so there's the danger of the neo-monasticism, right? Is the Father's Day sermon contradicting the church calendar and the bulletin? We have to be very careful about that. Okay, all right. I think two last concluding thoughts. A good day is when you look at the clock and it says 10 a.m. and you say, it's already 10 a.m. I had so much to do today. A bad day is when you look at the clock and it says 10 a.m. You're like, I could have swore it was lunch. Right? You've had good days and bad days, right? When you have those good days, it's when you've lost yourself in your job. When you've lost yourself in your job and the craft of your job. And when you lose yourself in the craft of your job, whatever it is, now I've already said some of you have an easier way of finding the craft than others, but you can find it no matter what, even cleaning the bathroom. When you lose yourself in that, all of the other stuff kind of goes away. The worry about being the best father and the best whatever and the money and the whatever and getting credit and the promotion or whatever. And you lose yourself in that craft. And you find pride, and the day goes bad like that. And I can almost guarantee you'll be more productive. And you'll be more valuable to the boss when you can lose yourself in the craft. And how do you get there? By loving it and loving the neighbor, right? By loving it and loving the neighbor and lose yourself in that. Because if you do it another way, then what you're doing is things for yourself. And now you've put yourself back under a law and you'll never be satisfied. So this is a concept of maybe virtue for the sake of virtue or sanctification for the sake of sanctification. The Greeks were really good at talking about virtue. We could learn a thing or two from them. However, there was maybe a couple things missing, and maybe one of them, at least in some of them, was the idea of love of neighbor. And so the good life was to live a virtuous life, right? To not get too high, not too low, not be wild, but not be a coward. In the middle would be courage. That's what you're trying to do. But the final goal, the final telos, the destiny, was to be virtuous for the sake of being virtuous. That's like being sanctified for the sake of sanctification. And it's a curved inward thing. And either you go down two roads. Either you go down to honest despair and know that you haven't, or delusional arrogance. You think you have. And in this one, you're sad and you're not productive. In this one, you're annoying the rest of us with your piety, right? So if I can take my sanctification and my virtue and make it about neighbor, now it becomes something really beautiful. And it's not just sanctification for the sake of sanctification or virtue for the sake of virtue. Rather, it is for neighbor. I'll close with this thought. Spiritual growth is one of those things where it's a little fuzzy in my mind. I think there needs to be more said about this. Remember when you were a little boy and you were growing and your mom put a little notch on the door, you know, the doorpost, and then you were just obsessed with getting bigger and taller. It just never happened as fast as you wanted, right? And the problem was you couldn't grow in the moment. Just stop and think about that. You can never grow in the moment. You can only look back upon growth. You can only look back upon growth. So let's say you get to like 15 or whatever, and your mom does that, and now you don't care. Now mom cares about the little notch on the whatever. And the reason for that is because, you have other things in your mind. You stop caring about growing. You stop caring about growing. I think you should have a plan for your spiritual growth, but I hope you get to the point where A, you realize you can only look back upon growth. You're never going to feel it in the moment. So don't even try. You're going to look back, oh, God put me there. Oh, that was good. But I hope you also get to the point where you stop caring about your spiritual growth because you're too busy loving, because you're too busy being who God made you to be and that is a righteous saint who is loving in vocation. Good enough? All right.
Thank you for listening. If you found this useful, the greatest gift you can give us is to pass it on to a friend. These recordings are free because of the support of our donors and sponsors. To visit our sponsors, to donate or to volunteer or to find more recordings, go to menofhisword.org. James and Timothy Rudat helped record and edit these episodes, and I am John Rudat, the technical manager for Men of His Word.